supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, the economy might be depressed, but our sex lives are not. USA Today says condom sales are booming, as well as sex toys, massage oils, and lubricants. 1,000 adults surveyed by Consumer Reports said their financial situation is not affecting their sex lives. Au contraire, the pharmaceutical industry is definitely encouraging this trend and continues to show large profits, especially with heavy marketing of erectile dysfunction drugs for all age groups. Well, does this emphasis on mechanics and medication reduce our desires and emotions to mere chemicals in our bloodstreams? And what does it say about the role of intimacy and emotional connection in our sexual lives? Well, joining me to discuss these issues are Dr. Debbie Herbeneck and Ian Kerner. Herbeneck is a sexual health researcher and educator at the Kinsey Institute. She's also co-director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University. And she's also the health educator at KinseyConfidential.org. Debbie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I'm also joined by Ian Kerner. He's a sex and relationship counselor, New York Times best-selling author of numerous books, including She Comes First and Love in the Time of Colic and Sex Detox. Ian, welcome to the show.
Hey there. How are you? Good. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Ian.
Our number is 888-477-9499. If you want to talk about sex in your relationship, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Debbie, let's start off with easy questions before we get too complicated. What is intimacy?
Intimacy is generally thought of as closeness, connection, the ways that we relate to other human beings.
So it's not necessarily sexual, right?
It's not necessarily sex. People can be intimate in emotional ways, sitting on a couch, having a great conversation over coffee. Sex is just one of many ways that we can be intimate with each other.
Ian, how would you answer that question?
I would agree that it's about the relationship between what's happening outside the bedroom and inside the bedroom. And I think more than anything, intimacy is being able to maintain a mental connection to your partner. And I think that intimacy also is about having an honest mental connection with your partner and having a positive attitude toward communication.
Words can have lots of different definitions, connection and mental connection. That might mean something different to everyone. So let's try to break that down. What does that mean? Ian, let's start with you.
What does a mental connection mean? Well, I think a lot of couples, especially in the first throes of romance, I think that there's a wonderful sense of expansiveness to a relationship, especially as you are getting to know somebody. And I think that, you know, we've all been intoxicated with infatuation. We've all wanted to learn everything about our partners and share everything with our partners. And, you know, one of the main things that I see in long-term relationships with the patients that I counsel is a lack of that sense of expansiveness. The relationship has hit a standstill. Communication has hit a standstill. There isn't necessarily even a strong interest in having a vital sense of intimacy and communication. So I would say that it comes down to nurturing that very important sense of expansiveness.
I'll tell you my read on that, Ian, and Debbie, I want to get your take on this, too. Ian, it sounds like you're almost talking about a genuine curiosity about the life of your partner, the psychological, emotional.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it, Daniel. I think I am talking about keeping a sense of wonderment alive and a sense of curiosity. And I think too often, especially in long-term relationships, especially when you're not seeking, when you're not trying to keep the relationship alive, when you're not trying to keep it interesting or vital, when things like routine and the typical sort of stressors and a certain sense of banality starts to infiltrate, I think that's when it becomes very difficult to nurture that sense of curiosity, and I think a lot of couples lose interest in each other at that point. And I think when you've stopped cultivating that natural curiosity, I think that's where the relationship becomes vulnerable. And you might be, because as humans, we're curious, aren't we? We're always curious. I mean, we may not always be curious about our partners or curious about the relationship, but we remain curious creatures and seekers of stimulus and seekers of information. And I think when you've stopped communicating with your partner, when you do not have that curiosity, that's where the relationship can become very vulnerable.
What are the things that concerns me, Debbie, is that when we mental health professionals talk about sex and relationships, we always use the word work. You have to work on it. And everybody I know is already working pretty hard. You know, we don't, that word work is kind of a turnoff. Is it necessary?
Work is one way of putting it, right? I think there are certainly other ways we can describe it, because I agree, work is kind of the last thing you want to do when you've come home from a day of work, right? But ideas of paying attention, paying more notice to something, being more caring, being more compassionate, I love this idea of being more curious about your partner. I do think that that often fades over time, and it's a shame, because that curiosity is what keeps that sense of expansiveness and that sense of connection alive. When you stop thinking of yourselves as two separate beings and start to think how you can get closer, how you can connect more, how you can be more intimate with another human being.
Let's talk about the relationship between this closeness, this curiosity, and sex. Debbie, they seem to have become disconnected in today's culture. There is sex and there is intimacy, and you don't necessarily need one for the other.
Well, I think there's a difference between what we see portrayed in media and what the reality is for most people. And I do think that most people, at least some of the time, you know, for many people, most of the time, are either already connecting the two or are trying very hard to connect the two. But I do agree that in the media, we often see them disconnected. We see sex, but we don't always see the intimacy, or we see very caring, committed, intimate relationships, but they, you know, maybe because of the network it's on or whatever else, we don't see the sex part. So we see them as if they exist in vacuums in media.
You know, intimacy and sex really are very often not the same thing. I mean, I spend a lot of time in the playground with my kids, and I spend a lot of time working with couples who have kids. And one of the things that I've observed is, you know, once you're really in that long-term relationship and you have kids, there's kind of a sense of transparency to the relationship and a sense of responsibility and predictability, and you become very scheduled, and you become there becomes almost too high a degree of transparency. And when you think about sort of the first throes of love, or you hear about why some people cheat because they're looking for a spark or an excitement or mystery, in some ways that sexual sense of mystery and that sexual sense of seeking really plays against the intimacy that can come out of a strong sense of closeness.
Well, Ian, this sounds like some of the issues you touched on in one of your books, Love in the Time of Colic. I mean, I can hear many people saying, you know, when the child's young, sex is the last thing I'm interested in, and I am exhausted at the end of the day. you know, to
me. Yeah, and there was, you know, I always used to cite a study by John Gottman out of Seattle, in which he did a bunch of research that showed that more than 70% of couples experience a decline in relationship satisfaction once they've had kids. And there was a new study that recently came out, Debbie. I don't know if you remember who did this study. For some reason, I think it was the National Institute of Health that said that number is as high as 90%, mm-hmm. that 90% of new parents experience a precipitous decline in relationship satisfaction.
Which puts everybody at risk, puts the marriage at risk, puts happiness certainly at risk.
It does, especially when we don't prepare people for that. I mean, there's, you know, it's very clear from the research that the vast majority of couples do experience a decline in sexual and relationship satisfaction after they have children. But that doesn't mean, of course, that people should stop having children. It does mean that we need to better prepare people for these declines so that when it happens to them, they don't say, does this mean we're not a good couple together? We're not a good family. We don't belong together. Instead, they can recognize it and say, okay, this happens. And now we're in this situation, and now we're experiencing this. And what do we do? What works for other couples? And I think, you know, Ian's book is one of those great tools that couples can really turn to figure out how people kind of navigate these tricky waters once you have children.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about sex and intimacy with Dr. Debbie Herbeneck. She's with the Kinsey Institute, and Ian Kerner, he's a sex and relationship therapist and has written many New York Times best-selling books. We'd like to hear your thoughts about sex and intimacy. We're going to hear about it, sex and intimacy throughout the life cycle. So we'd love to hear your issues, your questions. Our number is 888-477-9499. And let's take our first caller. We've got Louise on the line.
Hi. This has been a topic of discussion within my husband and me for months now. and it deals with intimacy. It deals with approaching each other and sex. And it's one of those things where I feel that if I don't make an effort, nothing happens, and it's very hard for me to make an effort, and I'm not sure quite where to go with the whole thing. You know, we've been married 20 years, we're now approaching 60, and my husband's feelings are that his libido is just not what it used to be, and I need to deal with it.
So,
and I'm not quite sure where to go with the whole issue.
Okay. So I think you dialed the right number, Louise.
Well, believe me, when I turned the car on and turned the radio on and you introduced it, I was on the phone speed dialing.
Yeah, well, I knew that. That's why we scheduled this show. you know, it's public radio. You know, you contribute. We aim to please our audience here. Ian,
I am a member.
Ian, let's hear your thoughts about Louise's situation. I am sure it is very common.
It is very common, but it's interesting because, you know, very often the media portrays the sex-starved husband. And what Louise is experiencing is what I've often experienced with the patients I counsel in my practice is a lot of men who are experiencing low desire. And so I first just want to, you know, appreciate Louise's call and to also, you know, hope that not only this show but other shows start to recognize that low male desire and sort of the sex-starved wife is also very much a cultural norm, and I think, you know, at approaching 60, there could be a lot of factors at play. There certainly could be biological or physiological factors due to waning testosterone levels. A lot of men, you know, I think there was a study that showed that men are most prone to depression and suicide in their 50s as they approach their 60s. So there's a lot of men out there who are also susceptible to various kinds of depression. And one of the first things that happens when a guy is depressed is very often the libido gets inhibited. And I think that it's also at a point where how do you begin to make sex interesting again and novel again? And, you know, you brought up, Dan, is, Daniel, a very good point at the beginning, which is that we use this term work, and a lot of people do approach fixing their sex life as though it's work, and I think part of the fun of it can be making talking about sex sexy and making the work itself fun and thinking about ways to engage your minds and not just criticize or complain, but actually share a fantasy together and get your minds stimulated again together or explore something new together. I mean, one of the wonderful things about being in a long-term relationship with somebody is that you hopefully do have that sense of intimacy where you can start to communicate very honestly, and you can potentially go to places where you've never been before in the relationship.
Can I, Louise, you and your situation to get myself some free supervision and consultation from Ian and Debbie? Mind being
sure?
Am I getting me? Thank you. So if you,
hopefully none of my friends are listening or my husband, but no, I'm very open about this.
And my guess is if you were free, if your friends were listening, they're many of them are in the same situation. So,
probably.
So if you and your husband were in my office, I would raise the following question. He's saying libido is what he does not have. And
right.
I'm coming back to my question about curiosity. Well, what does he have? I mean, what?
Well, he has a great deal of love for me. I know that. A great deal of respect. But he is very involved with his job and enjoys it and, you know, gets a great deal of satisfaction about that. And I'm delighted about that because it took him a long time to reach this place.
Well, I would want to explore that further about what his life means to him at this stage, getting back to what Ian suggested about depression, but even life cycle issues. What does his life mean to him at this point? What's important to him? What are his dreams and what are his fears in life going forward? Have that conversation between both of you, you know, to talk about these issues. We don't, you know, to have these intimate talks, we don't have to talk about libido and erection just yet. I mean, to me, these kinds of conversations are very intimate, and they're not demanding on anyone for anybody to change. So, Debbie, Ian, I'm curious. Is that a right direction for somebody like Louise and her husband?
I do, actually. I think both of both the physical and the intimacy aspects need attention because, you know, the other thing from a physical perspective that always deserves attention, especially for men in this age group, is, of course, erectile issues. And it's not just because it's the ability to have sex or not, but what we see with many men is that when they're having low desire or lack of interest in sex, sometimes it's because they know that their erections are less reliable, and sometimes that's a sign of other problems like diabetes or heart conditions. So even though that's not always the focus, even though that's not always true, you know, from a general health perspective, I always think it's worth kind of examining that, talking about it, exploring it, and if it is an issue, making sure that he's having regular health care to examine that further.
That's a great point. One of my concerns, though, is that too many doctors are doing with Viagra and its cousins what they do with antidepressants. As soon as someone says they feel sad, they write a prescription.
That does happen. However, Viagra isn't going to work for everyone either. So in some ways, you know, it does get overprescribed, I think. On the other hand, sometimes it ends up being almost a good thing because when it doesn't work well, and it doesn't always work well for many men, especially if they have other cardiovascular problems, then the next question is, if they haven't already done the workup, you know, let's do the workup and find out what's wrong. But, you know, back to your considerations about intimacy, you know, my personal feeling is that's a great way to go because what often happens is people may be in love with each other, they may respect each other, they may think that they're terrific, but that doesn't mean that they feel interested in sex. It doesn't mean that they're not attracted to their partner, but they may need to come at intimacy from a different angle. You know, there's comfortable intimacy and then there's excited intimacy. And I think along these conversations with what does your life mean to you right now, I think a good conversation is, you know, what is our shared life like? How do we have fun together? How could we have more fun together? What could we do that's more enjoyable? And even, you know, not even thinking how can we have more sex this week, right? But just the basic stuff of how can we continue to connect in new ways that excite us, that make us curious about the world and each other.
Hmm. Great answer. We've got to take a break, and all our phone lines are lit. So I'm going to reintroduce you, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. My guests are Ian Kerner. He's a sex and relationship counselor, New York Times best-selling author of numerous books, including She Comes First and Sex Detox, which we're going to talk about after the break. I'm also joined by Debbie Herbeneck. She's a sexual health researcher and educator at the Kinsey Institute, and she's a health educator at kinseyconfidential.org. She's got a book coming out in August, Because It Feels Good, A Woman's Guide to Sexual Pleasure and Satisfaction. Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Jay High, Homes for Adult Independence, supports WHYY and now offers a new service, Jay High at Home, an individualized program of life skill training and support, including money management, food preparation, personal hygiene, and more, all in the client's own residence. Jay High has been helping developmentally disabled people live independent lives for over 20 years. Details online at jhai.org, J-C-H-A-I.org.
Want to attend a Phillies game with WHYY's Ed Cunningham or a night out with a world-class orchestra or comedy event? WHYY offers a very unique opportunity. Summer Night Soiree and Silent Auction, Saturday, June 27th at WHYY. Come bid on great items from area businesses and institutions. Meet NPR's Frank DeFord, WHYY's Marty Moscowain and Ed Cunningham, and more. Summer Night Soiree and Silent Auction, Saturday, June 27th at WHYY. Visit whyy.org/summernights.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about sex and intimacy. Why are we having less intimacy but more sex? My guests are Debbie Herbeneck. She's a sexual health researcher with the Kinsey Institute, and she's can be found at kinseyconfidential.org. Ian Kerner is a sex and relationship therapist, New York Times bestseller of numerous books, including Sex Detox. Our number is 888-477-9499. Ian, you said that our sexual histories are more than just the number of partners we've had. It's also who we are and what we bring to these experiences. What makes our sexual history important, relevant?
Well, I think that a lot of us do measure our sexual history just in terms of past partners, but I think that our sense of sexuality, our interests, I think that those grow, those evolve over time, they deepen, they nurture. I think that our sexual identities are really a vibrant part of us that we do have to continually nurture and allow to evolve. And there's a term that sometimes gets used called a love map, which is sort of your unique sexual template, what turns you on, what turns you off, what your fantasies are, what your fears are. And I think that those are in a very dynamic and constant state of development and evolution, and we should think about our love maps and how to merge them and how to continue to grow them with our partners.
How so? What do you mean merge them?
Well, I think a lot of it is about what we have been talking about, which is that mental connection. I think sometimes we go into sex just sort of thinking it's something that should feel good and it should work well with another person and we should just fit together. But what turns on one person really might turn off their partner. What interests one person might not interest their partner. Somebody might bring something in their background that inhibits them in a particular way. So I think sort of merging your love maps in a way that you can respect your mutual turn-ons and turn-offs, your similarities and your differences, is really part of having a dynamic, intimate, and sexual relationship with a partner.
And Debbie, you know, before we took our break, we were talking about issues across the life cycle and the way we think about sex, what intimacy means, what we want, what pleasures us, is going to change over the life cycle also, yes?
It does, and, you know, traditionally it's changed in, I think, very interesting ways for men in particular, in the sense that, you know, what we've often seen with men is that men in their 20s, 30s, and to some extent even 40s, tend to often talk about their sexual satisfaction more in performance terms. You know, they were satisfied if they had good, reliable erections or good ejaculatory control, could last as long as they wanted, things like that. And what we've often seen more, not that they never speak of sexual satisfaction in intimate and emotional ways when they're younger, but that in terms of the lifespan, we tend to see more of that as men age, that they feel much more satisfied with closeness, with having sex in ways that don't just depend on having a reliable erection, and that they get so much more out of the intimate relationship with their partner. So I think, you know, that may be one of the many reasons why, even though many performance dimensions of sex decline with age, sexual satisfaction typically doesn't.
Huh. So all the more reason to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got John on the line. John, hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My first question is it true that as a man gets old, his sexual performance decreases, whilst as a woman gets old, her desire for more sex increases? And if a man is able to have an erection but cannot last too long during the sexual intercourse itself, is that considered to be a sexual dysfunction, and what are the remedies?
That's a good question, because it is a very common problem. So let's talk about first the issue of premature ejaculation. Debbie, let me turn to you.
Sure.
So what are the causes?
We've often been using the term now more rapid ejaculation more than premature, but it's kind of one of the shifts that's happening. And we are learning more about premature rapid ejaculation as time goes on. There seems to be a small subset of men that this tends to be more of, possibly genetics related, that the typical strategies don't work as well for in terms of sex therapy and so on. But we found more often that treatments such as the use of very certain antidepressants can actually help to help men last longer, but more often even treatments using sex therapy such as the stop, start, and squeeze techniques, which are masturbation techniques that men can practice on their own and then use with a partner to delay ejaculation.
So you're actually retraining your physiology.
You can retrain the way that you notice your physical responses. So these two techniques actually, even though they require some physical stimulation, what you're really training is you yourself noticing what do you feel right before you're about to ejaculate, and can you start to notice that and then stop yourself before you're about to ejaculate and maybe withdraw some of the sensations, stay still for a minute, or actually withdraw your penis or change sensation in some way. But there are many different causes. You know, for some it's performance anxiety, for some it's pressure from a partner. Other men actually are lasting quite long, but they think that they have premature ejaculation because in their minds, what they've heard from, you know, their friends or from media or from jokes is that they're supposed to last 15 or 30 minutes, and that's not realistic for most men.
And what we know about friends, media, and jokes is they're all liars.
Yeah.
our number is 888-477-9499. We are talking about sexuality, and more important, we're talking about intimacy and how one fosters the other. 888-477-9499. We'd like to hear your stories about your sexuality over the lifestyle, over your life cycle. What are the issues you're facing at this point in your life? Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jelena on the line. I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Nah, it's Yellen. It's all right. Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi. Actually, I'm 25. I'll be 26 in a week, and my husband and I, we're married for 4 years now. We have a 17-month-old and 3-month-old baby, and since having two little children, we don't have time to spend with each other, and actually, I'm at the point that I'm thinking I'm depressed, and I'm going to seek a doctor's advice.
Yeah.
So,
What's going on that's leading you to think you're depressed?
Well, it just seems like my husband is saying that I'm usually just complaining on top all the time, and that there is nothing to that I'm to worry about. We are happy and we are wealthy, healthy, and all of the stuff that is in life, it's good for us and it's doing well. It's just that I'm not satisfied, and I told him like I lost my butterflies because I usually was in love with him since I met him. And he's saying, well, that's all right. People don't get, you know, are not in love. That's all right. But I don't think that is all right.
Yeah, so in addition to your moods that you're feeling, it sounds like you've got a pretty significant disconnect with your husband.
Yes.
Yeah, and not to mention two small kids. Ian, what are your thoughts for?
Well, I think after you have children, it's really important to think about how can you be selfish when it comes to your relationship. I think that we tend to think that when we become parents that we are more selfless and we are preoccupied with the well-being of our children. And I think to really have a successful marriage and to be great parents, you have to remain connected to each other, and you have to think about ways that you can be selfish about your relationship. And I think that often means reprioritizing connection and intimacy, and reprioritizing simple things like a date night and getting out of the house and taking in new stimulus. I think it's very easy to get subsumed by your identity as parents, and I think so much of the energy that's sort of erotic in nature starts to become channeled into the child. It's the child that gets hugged all the time. It's the children that get touched all the time. It's the children that get talked to all the time. And so I really do think it's about becoming selfish again a little bit in terms of your relationship.
I would like to add also that, you know, going forward, as you know, you're a role model for your children, and one of the things you need to role model for your children is taking care of yourself and finding pleasure in your life and enjoying what there is to enjoy. Too many children don't have that with their parents. So I couldn't agree with Ian more. I think all of these things are important. I also, you know, you say you might be depressed and you're seeking the help of a doctor, and I'm very happy you're doing that because you might be depressed. And, you know, I would like to see you in counseling, and either individually or with your husband. And you can go there once a week with your husband and talk about the relationship and rebuild intimacy that way. But please do something every day that brings you some pleasure. It's very important. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Debbie, Ian, we've got to take another break. And I'll give out the phone numbers. We're talking about sexuality and intimacy across the life cycle, what the issues are, what we struggle with, what we don't struggle with. I'd like to hear from you, you know, if you have gotten through sexual intimacy issues over the course of your relationship. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. My guests are Debbie Herbeneck and Ian Kerner. Debbie's a sexual health researcher with the Kinsey Institute, and she's got a book coming out in August called Because It Feels Good, A Woman's Guide to Sexual Pleasure and Satisfaction. Ian Kerner is a sex and relationship therapist, written several New York Times bestsellers, including She Comes First, Love in the Time of Colic, and Sex Detox. Like I said, our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Jay High, Homes for Adult Independence, supports WHYY and now offers a new service, Jay High at Home, an individualized program of life skill training and support, including money management, food preparation, personal hygiene, and more, all in the client's own residence. Jay High has been helping developmentally disabled people live independent lives for over 20 years. Details online at jhai.org, jchai.org.
As an opposition leader, Zimbabwe's Morgan Tsvangirai used to speak out against longtime President Robert Mugabe.
Mugabe's crackdown on our people leaves a trail of broken limbs and dead bodies.
But now he's trying to convince the world that their coalition government is worth supporting. Join us for a rare interview with Zimbabwe's Prime Minister, Morgan Tsvangirai. That's next time on Tell Me More. This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about sexuality and intimacy with Ian Kerner and Debbie Herbeneck, Ian's sex and relationship therapist and New York Times bestselling author. And Debbie is a sexual health researcher and educator with the Kinsey Institute. Ian, I want to read part of something you wrote in a blog entry for the Huffington Post about really castigating us and our culture when it comes to sexuality. You said younger and younger men are turning to erectile stimulants such as Viagra, while a predilection for antidepressants wreaks havoc on what's left of our libidos. Meanwhile, stress, obesity, and lack of exercise is eroding our sexual fitness as we sit idly in front of our TVs, watching airbrushed, surgically enhanced strangers having sex instead of doing it ourselves. And you went on with this. It was pretty, sounded pretty angry about what's happening. You sound frustrated. So what does it mean to be our own kind of sexual person rather than the one we're watching on TV?
Well, I think both men and women are very subject to the images about sex and gender that come in through the media. I think we have a media that's pretty much obsessed with sex, but doesn't have the time or the courage to have real discussions about the kinds of issues we've been talking about sexuality. I think everything comes down to the sexy soundbite. I do a lot of morning TV and morning news, and there's sort of a format where things need to fit into little lists of five and snippets of advice. Mm-hmm. And I think meanwhile we struggle with our sexuality. We struggle with performance issues. We struggle with sexual creativity. We, as a culture, struggle with infidelity. I think we are increasingly hoping that there can be a pill that can suddenly give us the sex life we dream about. Meanwhile, we are a very sedentary culture. We are becoming unhealthier and unhealthier with our diets and often with lack of exercise and with stress, and all of that really takes its toll on our sexuality, and I think we have to look at our sexuality really in a much more holistic 360-degree angle, We have to look at our health and our fitness. We have to look at intimacy and how we're communicating with our partners. I'm sorry about that. Let me turn that off. My apologies. So I wish that we had a media that could really embrace that 360-degree perspective.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jill on the line. Jill, hi. You're on Voices.
Hi. My comment is about the need to be vulnerable with your partner. I had experience with my ex-husband. We had a very unfulfilling sex life, and I think that it had a lot to do with neither of us were really able to be very open and vulnerable in our sex life and our fantasies with each other. And since being divorced from him and finding a new partner to have a very rich and fulfilling sex life with, I think a lot of it stems with feeling safer and just being more open in a way that you aren't with any other person except for the one that you're in that intimate sexual relationship with.
Yeah, it's interesting. Everything you said makes sense, but, you know, from a mechanical viewpoint, you know, you said you had trouble being vulnerable with your ex-husband and vice versa, but when you think about it, you're both naked with each other. You know, you are as vulnerable as you can be. So it really points to the difference between physical vulnerability and emotional. Debbie, you have any thoughts about that?
I think this is one of the more rich areas to talk about when we talk about sex and intimacy. You know, the irony of vulnerability and sexuality is that we often find it far easier to take risks with strangers than we do with our own partners because we have nothing to lose with strangers. So you have people telling deep, dark secrets to somebody sitting next to them on a bus or an airplane or a subway, but not, you know, the person that they share their bed with. And so when we can actually try to take a risk with someone and tell them something private about ourselves or act sexual in a way that we're not sure if they accept, if we take that risk and they respond well, and they accept us, they don't make fun of us, whatever the case is, then we tend to feel much more cemented and bonded to them. When neither one of us ever takes those risks, then you keep your distance and you don't become intimate. Of course, that also requires a partner who is going to accept you. And maybe, you know, I don't know what your past relationship was like, but maybe in your past relationship you had experiences of one or both of you of not really feeling accepted when you had made yourself vulnerable. But, you know, it's absolutely essential to put yourself at risk in order to get those deeper rewards.
You know, it's interesting, Debbie and Jill, you know, when the reason we don't open up, just like Debbie said, is, you know, we're afraid of being hurt or we're afraid of being shamed. And the more closed we are, probably there's more hurt and shame in our history. But the way our brains work is we remember the hurt, but we never remember the recovery. So that every time we were hurt, we got over it, but we don't recall the getting over it part. You know, we just hold on to the getting hurt part, so we stay closed off. It's kind of sad, you know. Our brains are far from perfect.
Well, and I think many of us are in relationships where we have just never cultivated the habit of talking about sex because it makes us blush. It makes us embarrassed. I have a little exercise that I sometimes do with couples who are very uncomfortable talking about sex and feel like they'll be judged if they bring up a fantasy or a desire, or they'll be rejected. And I say, why don't you just, when you wake up in the morning, tell your partner you had a sexy dream about them. Just say, you know, I don't know what was going on in my dream life last night, but I had a really sexy dream about you. And usually something as simple as just one sentence saying, I had a sexy thought about you, or I had a sexy dream about you, it awakens that curiosity, and it makes it easier to share something and talk about it and turn each other on, frankly.
Wonderful. Jill, thanks so much for your call. Debbie, I got a question about Kinsey Confidential. You're the person that answers those questions. What are the most common questions you get from men, women?
From men, we get a lot of questions about wanting to last longer, about how to get their partner more interested in sex, as well as erection problems. From women, we regularly get questions about how they can learn to have orgasms. We get a lot of questions about desire as well. And more particularly from women, we get a lot of health-related questions. So how does sex change after I have a hysterectomy or during menopause or after I have a baby? And then we get a lot of questions from very young readers and listeners who are very concerned about pregnancy, which really, can I get pregnant if? And you can imagine the number of scenarios that comes after that, which really highlights to me their, you know, this lack of information from early on.
Yeah, I was just going to say or ask, but what does that tell us about the state of sexual education across generations in this country?
Ooh, the state of sexuality education is pretty poor. And, you know, our conversation in the media tends to be about sex education in schools. That's the hot topic. How, you know, what should we or should we not be teaching children, whether in elementary school, middle school, or high school, about sex? What we need to be doing, too, though, is figuring out how we educate adults about sex. You know, this is certainly one medium, but as, you know, as Ian mentioned, you know, there are a lot of, you know, these morning shows, for example, that don't really have the capacity in terms of their format or what they're able to, you know, legally say on TV to have the kinds of conversations that adults need to be having to have better sexual and intimate relationships.
Yeah, and rather than, you know, three steps to the perfect orgasm, I you know, coming back to the issue of curiosity, and curiosity starts with ignorance. You know, I don't know. I don't know these answers. I don't know how you feel. Sometimes I don't even know how I feel. And those kinds of issues are the beginning of a really rich conversation. But somehow not knowing has become shameful in this country.
And it's especially shameful, I think, and difficult for men to say, I don't know. And I think that there are many, many young men who still feel a pressure to know it all and to be in charge and to not be asking the questions but be providing the answers without really knowing what they are.
Well, that's always been the case for men, hasn't it, from time immemorial? I think since we've been on walking on two legs, we've had those expectations on us.
Well, I think we need more expectations that we should know about sex. Like, it's okay to know these things, and it's, you know, and it's really an ethical issue that we should be able to teach our children, you know, about their bodies and about how they work.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Phil on the line. He's been waiting patiently for a while. Phil,
thank you, Dr. Dan. It's a wonderful show.
Thank you.
Let me say, I'm 63 years old, and I agree totally that it's your life experience, and because I've gone through a lot of trial and error, that finally gets you to the point where you understand what it's all about or starting to understand what it's all about. I met someone through a social network about 6-8 weeks ago, and it culminated with my taking a trip to the Midwest last week, spending about 8 days with the woman who I met, and we, of course, had to communicate with nothing but language and to share our feelings, and each time I started to get closer to her, I found myself telling her things that I was afraid that would be a deal breaker here, and through that honesty and work both ends, because we're both like that, it turned into, actually, I can truly say it was the best sex I ever had in my life last week. And mechanics were never a problem. But the intimacy is a very, very long journey to learn.
Yeah, so you seem to be suggesting then that just having words makes it easier for you to open up, to be vulnerable. I'm curious.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we were going back over talking about the week we spent, and the two incidents that remained the most vivid on our minds were the time after having sex, laying there kind of in candlelight, and just looking at each other and talking, and sometimes not even having to talk.
Yeah,
but just having looking in each other's eyes and having a feeling go back and forth. I'm starting to break up and not from being unhappy, but the other way.
Phil, I'm happy. I'm happy for you. Thanks. Thanks so much for your call.
How right on what the discussion is about the difference between mechanics and intimacy.
I appreciate that. We got to go. We're running out of time.
Thank you, Dr. Dan.
Thanks for your call, Ian. You wrote an article about five love lessons we can learn from the Obamas. Can you just tell us a couple?
Well, I think the Obamas can be incredible role models for how to be a loving, intimate, and very busy couple. They just took the time to have a wonderful date night, date weekend in New York. And I know plenty of parents who have not given themselves that privilege in years. I think it's wonderful the way they hold hands and kiss and cuddle and connect. I don't know about you, I don't know about Debbie, but I feel like this is the first time that I believe that a president is really having loving, intimate, connected sex with his wife, and I think it's very inspiring.
Well, it's certainly the first time I remember in my lifetime, and I'm also 63, and I'm just guessing that, you know, President Obama and his wife, they're both probably pretty busy people. I mean, they got stuff to do, you know, and they seem to find time for love and intimacy in their relationship.
And curiosity. They have some great quotes about the wonderment of each other.
Oh, really? I haven't read that. Well, that does get us all the way back to the beginning of the show, is about that kind of curiosity that really enriches our relationship. It enriches our lives when we can be curious about our partner and even curious about ourselves and our lives. It's all in there. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It's been a rich, informative, and important show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
My guests have been Dr. Debbie Herbeneck. She's a sexual health researcher and educator for the Kinsey Institute. She's also with Gender and Reproduction at Indiana University. Her new book is called Because It Feels Good, A Woman's Guide to Sexual Pleasure and Satisfaction. Ian Kerner is a sex and relationship therapist. He's written many books, including She Comes First, Love in the Time of Colic, and Sex Detox. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about the broad and important issues of immigration. And join me at philly.com/askdan tomorrow for my web chat. It's going to be on kindness and lessons learned from my recent trip in Taiwan. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of radio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your day, my friend.
It's sunny and